You ready, Debbie? Okay, let's call to order the meeting of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's Wednesday, February 1st. This will be our short meeting, then we'll be into 8 a.m. meeting. So those of you who are late risers, this will be your last chance to enjoy the House Transportation and Economic Development Committee. Let's begin by adopting committee rules. Colleagues, you've got the model committee rules that all committees are looking at in front of you. Any questions about those? Do we have a motion to adopt these rules?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development Model Committee Rules.
Co-Chair Bentz moves adoption of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development Committee Rules. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, in the spirit of Representative Greenlick, his questions will be on testimony in many other committees today, so I will spare this committee with those questions.
Okay. Any other discussion? Any objection? Rules are adopted. So since we have Representative Kenmer in the room, let's do these bills in the reverse order. We'll jump down and open a public hearing on House Bill 4043. Right forward, Representative Kenmer. Yeah, please both come forward. Patrick, please brief us a little bit on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4043 allows the Department of Transportation to reinstate a person's suspended driving privileges or right to apply for privileges or any identification card or right to apply for such card under certain circumstances if the suspension offense is for failure to give required or correct information on an application for driver license permit or application card or for commission of false swearing on such an application. We do currently have in hand the statement of minimal fiscal impact and statement of no revenue impact, unlike what your staff measure summary say. We had printed those before we received those right before the meeting. So we have minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no amendment on this measure, Mr. Chair.
And actually, Amy, why don't you go ahead and come forward, too, since we have an extra chair. We can have all three of you and have better dialogue probably that way. I assume you're fine with that.
Okay. Representative Kenmer. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Welcome.
Co-Chair, member of the committee, for the record, Bill Kenmer, State Representative District 39. Thank you for this hearing and this opportunity to talk about House Bill 4043, which comes as a result of a constituent concern. The Department of Motor Vehicles some time ago instituted a facial recognition software. And what they're doing is they're discovering in that some 50 to 100 citizens a year, constituting about 10 to 25%, because it varies a lot, are recognized as individuals who at one time or another have been engaged in some false identity things, usually related to typically drinking alcohol to avoid the age limit. A constituent of mine at 34 years of age, a married lady with two children, a prominent business person, went to DMV and discovered that an adolescent indiscretion of hers from when she was 18 came, they discovered that she had used a fake ID. And as a result, the rules are quite arbitrary. Despite the fact that this was a long time ago and she's been a model citizen and an active citizen involved in our community, it resulted in automatic suspension and severe difficulties in trying to get any kind of other alternative sentence or anything else. And at the time, she was also functioning as a realtor. You can see the hardship there. And ultimately, Mr. Oliver is here and he will explain a few things about this as well. It seemed to me that this is a concern. We ought to find a little bit better way to do this. I think my concerns were that there was virtually no due process. It's an automatic suspension regardless of the grounds. And the penalty is not necessarily proportionate to the crime when it's a long time ago and this person has been a model citizen since. And there is no room under the current statute really to do much in the way of negotiation or arbitration. So with me today is Mr. Oliver, who will be here to share briefly about his wife and their story. And then I've worked with DMV and particularly Ms. Amy Joyce in coming up with what we think is a very sensible, inexpensive, efficient way to handle this. And I got to say, as a state representative, it's awkward to have a constituent come when things don't seem to work right, and I think this is an opportunity to rectify that, and I want to thank DMV for their cooperation, too, in finding an economically responsible way to do this. So with that, if we could, I'd like to hear from Mr. Oliver.
Yeah, please. If you could pull the mic over and introduce yourself for the record. Welcome.
For the record, my name is Ryan Oliver. I want to thank the co-chairs and committee for the time. As Representative Kennemere here has said, my wife had an indiscretion back in her college days where she acquired a fake ID, which I'm sure she's the only one that's ever done that before. And 14 years later, it came back to get her when she went in to get her license renewed. When we found out, we got a bunch of mail from the DMV that said, your license suspended. We implemented facial recognition in 1997, and now you're forced with a one-year suspension, no ifs, ands, or buts, which obviously puts a hardship on our. She's we're a dual-income family. She drove for a living, so it had the potential to be a real nightmare for us. She was eligible to get a hardship license, but within this statute, you are not able to drive with your kids. So she can drive for work, but no family time is allowed. And I believe under other hardships, maybe Amy, you can maybe speak to this. There's a clause in there that lets you at least drive with your kids for a certain amount of hours a week or something to that effect. But with this one, it was zero kids. And so, obviously, that's another hardship. And I guess I also want to say is, this isn't going to benefit me. So we're not. I don't want to come here and act like we're mad because we got caught or she got caught, and now we're trying to find a way out of it. Her suspension is going to be for the year, no matter what, if this thing passes or not. So this, for me, this is more for people coming down the pike that are going to be hit with this. She was 14 years later, with license renewing every 8 years or so. I mean, she could, you know, this could be easily 20 years after the fact where you're going to end up with a license suspension. So just a couple quick notes here, one of them being that in the criminal code, I believe it's under ORS 165.800, they separate true identity theft versus getting a license for alcohol purposes. And so this is, by passing this, this would put the statute more in line with the criminal code of saying, okay, are you truly trying to do ID theft, or are you just being a knucklehead 20-year-old and getting a fake ID? Also, with the no statute of limitations, you know, 14 years for my case, but it could very easily be 20 years down the road for good, hardworking people who are making an income for your family. Obviously, could become a major hardship. The third thing I have here is that with that SR-22, my wife's company was very gracious enough to let her have the SR-22 and keep her job. There's a lot of professions out there, you know, truck drivers. She was outside sales. So if you get the SR-22 that comes along with the hardship, a lot of insurance companies will automatically cancel, and therefore they would lose their job. And obviously, in these economic times, not to hopefully we're on that going out of those, but in the meantime, that could be a great financial hardship to those as well, losing your job for something you did 15 years prior. And and lastly, I just want to say that the you know, we've worked together with ODOT and the DMV to come up with what we think is a pretty good plan to make that exception for those that were using a fake ID, so to speak, versus those that were actually using getting IDs for identity theft purposes on that. So with that, if there's any questions at this point, or I don't know if Amy wants to.
Okay, well, why don't we ask Amy to weigh in, and then we can have questions for all three. Amy, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Hunt, Chair Mentz, and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Just a little bit of history on this so you understand where it came from. In 2005, the legislature passed a law saying that DMV should use biometric data when issuing and renewing driver licenses and ID cards, and the idea behind that was to combat combat identity theft, and also people who would come in for a second identity when they were already suspended, had their driver license suspended, come in and get a new identity so they could have a quote-unquote valid driver license. So the law was passed to combat those crimes. And almost certainly unintended consequence of that was that the system began catching people who did, in fact, fraudulently obtain a driver license or ID card, but did so many years ago for the sake of getting alcohol before they were 21 or going into bars or taverns. And so the system that DMV uses is called facial recognition, which compares using mathematical algorithms, really. They compare the photograph that is taken while you're at the DMV to your old photograph that DMV has on file, and then also to all of the photographs that DMV has in the system. So it does that one-to-one check to see if you're the same person who came in last time under that name, and also makes sure that you don't look like three other people in the system, so that you have multiple identities. And it's been very effective over the last three or so years that it's been fully implemented. DMV's caught about 1,000 people who've been caught in facial recognition as having fraudulently obtained identification. And about 10% to 25% of those, we estimate, were probably for the sake of just for the sake of getting alcohol and no other sort of nefarious reason. So again, that was likely an unanticipated result of that law that the legislature passed, and it does result in a one-year driver license suspension. So what the bill would do is if a person were caught in facial recognition for having gotten a fake ID, if they did so solely for the sake of getting alcohol or getting into bars, they can go to DMV and ask for an administrative review, and there will be objective criteria to determine whether the reason was most likely for alcohol. And if the person can do that, then they can get their license reinstated. $75 reinstatement fee, and they do have to do something proactive. So there is an element of consequence or sanction, but certainly not the one-year full suspension that is in existence under the current law. So that's what the bill will do, and we worked with Representative Kenemer on how this would work out, and it looks like a solution we can implement.
Great. Thank you all. Questions? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions. One, how do you estimate that you said 10 to 25% were only for the purpose of alcohol? What methodology do you use to get that number?
Co-chairs and Representative Reed, we did a sampling of 100 people who were caught in the FRS system and looked at them in terms of did they get the fake ID before they were 21? And then did they have any other suspensions on their record? So those folks would drop off. And that came to around 10 or 11% of that 100-person sample. Our fraud investigators, using the criteria only that the person was under 21 when they obtained the false identification, and the date of birth they used on that false identification made them older than 21. Using that, sort of anecdotally, they estimate about one quarter of the fraud cases they investigate are of that ilk. So it's somewhere in there is our best estimate.
One other question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Reed.
Thanks. You mentioned in the bill mentions objective criteria that might be considered in a petition sort of situation. Can you talk about what, recognizing that hasn't yet been done, if the bill were to pass and go through rulemaking and so on, what might those criteria be?
Co-chairs and Representative Reed, what we're looking at currently would be you were under 21 when you obtained it. The fake identification made you appear to be older than 21. You had no suspensions on your record when you obtained that fake ID, which would indicate a different purpose in getting it. Let's see. I think there was one other. I'm sorry, I'm blanking. But it would be the point of having it be objective criteria, Representative Reed, is the idea that avoiding full-blown contested case hearings where people bring in, you know, witnesses to character and all kinds of things, which becomes very expensive and can lead to some pretty inconsistent results. So the bill does say objective criteria. The person will submit information or their driving record, and they're either going to meet it or they aren't, and that's going to be the end of it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, thank you, and Representative Reed. We had this discussion, and frankly, I started to create a laundry list. And, you know, it gets really hard to get that laundry list right. And if we're not careful, we create a very arbitrary system. And what we're trying to do is a flexible, simple system. In Mrs. Oliver's case, this person has been a model citizen. In other situations, I think there needs to be sensitivity to their conduct and their police record and other matters that would result in a rather remarkably different outcome. But proportionality is a common perspective in our law, that the punishment should fit the crime. This is an indiscretion, a fraud, by the way. Let's be clear. The wrong thing to have done, that's not what we want. But frankly, as I've discussed this around, I've been amazed at how many, and I'm grateful it's one of the few indiscretions of my adolescence that was not mine. So, but there are lots of others, and I think we all have had that. And I think this is a really responsible, easy, efficient way to do this. And really, it gets expensive and pretty much not appealable under current law. And it will affect perhaps 50 to 100 people per year for the next 6 to 8 years as this goes on through. That's not a lot, but, you know, that's one or two of our constituents a year for each of us. That's quite a few to have go through an arbitrary process that really isn't, in my mind, fair.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Three questions. You said it was inexpensive. So my question is, how expensive? How much will it cost? That's number one. Number two would be, why stop at 21? What about the people that are 22? And then number three would be, what happens after the year suspension as it is right now?
Amy, you want to go ahead and address that because you dealt with the numbers. And so the expense is $75.
And let me clarify why I'm asking about the 21 age. I mean, maybe someone had an indiscretion at 25, and they've lived a good life for 20 years as well, but they don't fall under this.
Co-chairs and Representative Lindsay, the expense will be the $75 reinstatement fee to get their license back after they've gone through the process. To do the process will be relatively inexpensive. The person will have to take the effort to submit information to DMV. There's talk about having a notarized statement with the person swearing that this is in fact the reason they committed this act. So that's a small cost there, but there is some time cost to the individual, and then the dollar cost is the $75 reinstatement fee. In terms of why 21, all that I can say on that is that the idea here was for people who did this for the sake of, you know, purchasing alcohol or going into bars and taverns. That age is 21. There was not discussion about going outside of the alcohol issue to other indiscretions of youth, for lack of a better term. That was the idea behind this concept from Rep. Kenemer. And I apologize, I've lost the third question.
What happens after the year?
So co-chairs and Representative Lindsay, after the 1 year under current law, the person is no longer suspended, and they have to come in to DMV and sort of re-up their license. So once any license suspension ends under the law, at that point you're no longer suspended, but you don't have valid driving privileges until you come in and proactively regain your driving privileges. So the same thing occurs today after the 1 year suspension.
Okay. And just to clarify then, and I've read this as carefully as I can, so just for legislative public intent here, this is exclusively limited to alcohol.
I think it's appropriate for me to speak to that. Yes. I think we're looking at one specific indiscretion, and that is more, you know, we don't want to get into actual other kinds of fraud where people are using fake ID to cash checks or do any multiple of other bad things. We're looking at an alcohol indiscretion. You know, in talking to people, the common notion back 20 years ago was, oh, it's no big deal, and you won't get caught, and it won't matter. Well, of course, that was misinformed, but nonetheless, and wrong. I want to be clear about that. I'm not saying this was fine to do. It was not truthful. But on the other hand, when people have led an appropriate life and not engaged in fraud and not cheated other people, and there's no record of that, then I think it's appropriate. Did I get it at the point,
yeah.
Representative
Lindsay? Let me just follow up on that, because as I read on four, what section I'm in here, section 2, sub 4, capital B, it looks like it has not only the attempting to purchase consumer acquired alcoholic beverages, but it also has the related, but I think technically separate, attempting to enter. So it could be entering a place for the purpose of consuming alcohol. It could be entering a place where minors are restricted for the purpose of buying a lottery ticket or buying cigarettes or something else. So my sense is it's in the same vein, but it's just to put a finer point on Representative Lindsay's question, I think it's slightly broader. Is that how you read it, too?
It is, and thank you for that correction.
Co-chair, Betts.
Mr. Chair, as I read Section 4, the review does not stay the suspension, so the person is still going to suffer the consequences of the suspension as a result of this recently discovered indiscretion. Is that correctly
understood? Chair Bounce, that's accurate. The person will be suspended.
And so, just follow up, Mr. Chair. So the indiscretion does not go without its punishment upon discovery. It's odd because it's, at least so many, in this case, so many years after the fact. The statute's 3 years. Statute of limitations is 3 years. And so it is interesting that under our approach, which may have been in part driven by the fact that we can't go back under old circumstances and figure out what you did 3 years ago, but now we're being given this new technological means of doing exactly that. Someone might ask, what are we going to do with our statutes of limitations, which had many things to do with inability to go back in time and prove what actually happened. I just point this out because it's of interest to me for two reasons. First, why the 3 years under our old statutes, and maybe we should start revisiting them, I'd rather not. And the other is, will the department be looking at events that occurred after they turned 21 between then and now? Because that raises a whole set of really unfortunate issues. I just want to know. This goes back to the criteria question asked earlier.
Co-chairs, Chair Bounce, so I would leave the 3-year statute of limitations on the criminal matter to the criminal lawyers. In terms of criteria, to Rep. Reed's earlier question, that the rule has not yet been written, and so the things I describe are those being considered. Another one that I thought of after blanking later was that there were no other instances of seeking a fake identification other than this one. So certainly the department could look at other objective criteria being what's in the criminal record. You know, you have to bring in a certified copy of your criminal record to see if there are other activities on there. So there are other things that could be done that are objective criteria that could make it into the rule.
Hello. Please. I'm just interested in the foundation for what we're about, I think, is that there was a youthful indiscretion. For that, we're going to let you off the hook, even though you're going to have to pay a penalty for because your license has been suspended. But if we discover that you've been a really bad person between then and now, we're not going to let you have this break. And that seems to be like a judgment issue, and I wonder about that. But so I guess you guys will be discussing that in your rulemaking. We're giving you, apparently, the green light to go ahead with rulemaking, but it'd be a very interesting discussion. So. I don't pretend to know how to answer those questions.
Chair Benz, yes, that's right. That would be through the rulemaking, which will, the bill doesn't go into effect until January of 13. So the department...
It has an emergency clause.
I'm sorry, I believe an operative date of January. And so the rule writing process can begin, but it will be a full-blown notice opportunity for public comment. I'd be happy to, you know, loop in anybody who's interested in the rule writing process. You know, I think that the only limitation in the statute on that is that it be objective criteria. So if the department were to go that direction of looking at future actions on a criminal record or a driving record, it would be clearly objective criteria.
Thank you.
Representative Whitaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm supportive of the bill and what we're doing here, but I kind of have issues because we're going back 15 years and somebody just went in to get, what if they just mailed in and you just send them the renewal for their license and they didn't come in and change it? You wouldn't have a picture to identify them. And we're going to suspend their license for a year, put them on a suspension, and make the person suffer with an SR-22 for a crime they had done 15, 20 years ago? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because an SR-22, didn't that double your insurance? You probably got dropped by one insurance company. Then you're looking at your insurance going from $100 or $200 a month probably to $200 to $400.
For most, yes. Luckily, I'm an insurance agent, and so my carrier let me bend the rule a little bit to add that on there. But yes, if you were somebody off the street and you were with a preferred carrier, they don't do the SR-22 bit, so they're gonna put a cancel on you, and then you'd have to rewrite with a substandard company, and obviously that means rate.
So here's my problem. I mean, we're doing this to kind of correct something, but when they got caught and arrested for that indiscretion, didn't they pay their penalty and serve their time, or the judge imposed something on them at that time, and now we're going to just out of the blue throw another penalty on top of them?
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, in all, most cases, the person never was caught. The only reason it's coming up now is because of this technology that the legislature directed DMV to use. It's matching up these photos and recognizing that the photos don't match, and you're a different person. And it's also the case that no longer can you mail in for renewals of driver licenses every year, or every time you need to renew, which is now an 8-year renewal cycle. You must come into the DMV, get a new photo, and so you are getting a new photo every time, except for some extremely rare circumstances.
Can I ask a question about Section 4? The way I'm reading Section 4, and maybe I'm misunderstanding it, it talks about applying only to acts, which I think is not the act of suspension. I think that's the act of the fake ID committed before. I missed the word before when I read that. Okay, now that makes perfect sense to me. I read it as on or after, and I thought, why aren't we applying it broadly? But asked and answered. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I may, just one
please.
Last comment. As we struggled with this, there's not a very good solution for a problem so old. And there is existing law that does provide for a penalty that I think is inappropriate in many instances. This is the best we could figure out. Okay. And I appreciate your indulgence. Thank you very much.
Thank you for putting this together. Thank you for bringing this forward. And Amy, thanks for working on it. So, colleagues, let me go ahead. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify? And those are the only folks that had signed up. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4043 and open a work session on House Bill 4043. What is your pleasure on this, colleagues? As Patrick said, we do have, surprisingly, both the no revenue statement and the minimal fiscal impact statement. Back, there are no amendments that have been drafted for this. So what is your pleasure today? It seems like my sense is there is support on the committee to pass it. The question is, do we want to do that today, or do you want some further time to contemplate? Representative Wyden.
Mr. Chair, I'd be eager to pass the first bill, first day out of this committee.
Okay.
Same here.
Co-Chair Betts?
I'm perfectly happy to pass it out of the committee. Some of the discussion, and in fact, Representative Widener's last question, I think was getting to the issue that's not addressed by the bill, and that is why are we going back? And now that we have this device that allows us to look back that 15 years or 8 years, whatever it is, why don't we simply say if we're beyond the statute, you're off the hook? And that's a broader discussion for what I think is going to become more and more of an issue as we come.
Right.
We're better able to look into our past. But that's another discussion, but I'm ready to move the bill also.
It may be a good proactive issue to put on the rest of our interim agenda as we have additional hearings. That may be a good bill to queue up for 2013. Because I think you're right. Representative Wyden.
I mean, Representative Bence is actually right where I was at, because we're only 3 years and we're going back 8 years, because now they have to go in every 8 years for a new photo. We're opening a can of worms here with this facial recognition, I think.
Just so there's clarity, so the previous legislation that passed and is now law opened that can of worms.
Right.
Sorry, I just want to separate what this bill...
I was no part of that legislation.
yes. We are in a work session. Would someone like to make a motion on House Bill 4043?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4043 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Bence moves House Bill 4043 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll support the motion of the bill. I think there remain a number of questions for me voiced by Representative Bence, and I still struggle a little bit with the idea that because something happened a long time ago that is objectively established in this case, that we're not going to I worry that this may be setting some precedent about not taking that fraud seriously, but I recognize the other issues, and I'll support the bill.
Yeah, this is a tough one for me. I'm going to end up being a no. I might be the only no, and I understand anybody that's voting yes on this, but I'll be a no at this time because of Tobias's Representative Bence or Reed's concerns. I'm wondering if it's better to address our concerns and this in a bigger package instead of this little tiny Band-Aid. So that's why I'm voting no on it, why I'll be voting no.
Any further discussion? Since we are going to have some no votes, will you please call the roll?
Representative Lindsay?
No.
Representative Nathanson?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Reed?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Co-Chair Bence?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Bence? Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kenimer, are you willing to carry
on the floor?
Representative Kenimer will carry on the House floor. Thank you very much. And, you know, based on Representative Greenlick's comments this morning, we all may want to be ready to declare potential conflicts of interest as this bill comes to the floor. So be on guard. Not Lindsay. Close the work session on House Bill 4043 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4029. Patrick, please bring us up to speed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4029 was one of the measures that our committee introduced as a committee bill. This is the one that directs the Oregon Transportation Commission to report annually to the legislative committees on transportation, requiring funding available for transportation projects outlined in Section 64 of House Bill 2001 from 2009. The measure declares an emergency, would take effect upon passage. We have in your packets the Dash 1 amendment, which I believe I was not at the January meeting, unfortunately, so I believe it was discussed. This is the amendment that would change the reporting date from what the bill says, which is March 1st to November 1st. That's to align with timing of highway projects, as I'm sure our witness will testify to, Ms. Chair. We, like you said before, we do not have the fiscal impact statement on the original bill or the dash ones at this point.
Welcome back, Paul. Please proceed.
Good afternoon. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Transportation, here testifying House Bill 4029. As we talked about in the interim session, this bill
has to do with the Jobs and Transportation Act that was passed in 2009. One of the many, many aspects of that bill specified specific projects in Section 64. For the first time, actually specified dollar amounts and limits to very specific projects in statute. What the proposed bill in front of you, what it would do would require the Oregon Transportation Commission to do two things. First is, on an annual basis, provide to you the savings on various projects identified in that bill that would be available for redistribution to other projects. And the second thing would be to require them to give you a priority order of where they would put those funds that were available. In the original bill, It was stated that March 1st would be the date of that requirement, and as I suggested in the interim and what's in the amendments, we would support the November reporting date seems to line up with more of our when we construct or finish construction on projects and when our bid letting season is, which in the spring is a better timing of the year to have those reports due.
Questions for Paul? We did hear this at our last meeting. Representative Weigert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going to stray a little bit, has some to do with the bill, but question I have, with the funds that are coming in since we implemented the Jobs and Transportation Act and the increased revenues that are coming from that, is that money being set aside for these projects so our bonds won't be so high, or what's happening with the funds as they come in from the Jobs and Transportation Act?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Widener, I guess the first point is we're seeing the revenue that we projected to come in under the bill. We're actually seeing less revenue that was projected, and so we're challenged with the amount of expectations that are set for these projects and the amount of revenue that's actually coming in. And so that's one of the issues we're tracking, is the amount of money actually that is coming as a result of the increases in the gas tax to go towards these projects. We're not seeing the revenue to support the project that are identified in the bill. So we're tracking that that information. The amount of money that does come in is set aside for that. We have not sold any of the bonds yet for the projects. Most of the major projects in the Jobs and Transportation Act don't go to bid until 2013. We have a number of projects have gone to bid already, but they're the smaller projects. So we haven't had a cash flow issue that would require us to sell bonds. And so the money that is coming in, we're able to fund the projects that are kind of in the cash flow process now that hasn't required us to sell bonds yet.
If I may follow up, please. Is this something that's taken care of with the less revenue coming in? Is it going to equalize us where we're earning interest on the money to pay for these projects up front rather than having to bond them?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative, probably not. But the amount that we're seeing, at least so far, about a 7% reduction in our revenue than we projected. We're not realizing that amount of savings. Also, remember, in Jobs and Transportation Act, there was anticipation that the money that we did accrue during this time would go towards additional projects. And so we anticipated that during this time when we hadn't sold the bonds, that there would be money accumulated, and we actually stretched the dollars further than what the bonds would support for that various reason. So that thought process was already built into the bill, and now that we're seeing less revenue, it's become problematic for us, but we haven't got to that point where it's actually become a problem because we haven't sold the bill. So we're waiting to see what the economy does, what happens to our, the revenue, and just how big of an issue this may turn out to be before we come back before you with a report on that.
Yeah. Co-Chair Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That follows that. The bill, of course, says the amount of funding available for reallocation as a result of projects with less funding. The question would be the point you're raising, which is what happens if we don't have the money to do the projects at all? So the bill doesn't really speak to that. It's just the opposite.
Mr. Co-Chair, that's correct. One of the recommendations that may come back from our commission may be to raise this very issue, to say we're not having enough revenue. Our recommendation would be to set aside these funds to not fund additional work, but to make sure the projects that we have committed to are able to fund.
Follow up. I guess my question is, if we don't have the money to fund the projects that were on the list, what happens?
We'd be back in front of you with that problem, because they're in statute that we have to build these projects at this dollar amount. If the revenue doesn't materialize, we'd be back in front of you with that situation, and hopefully work through a solution to that.
And follow up. And thank you, Mr. Kocher. And when would that be? When will we know whether the project, when the funds are available?
Yeah, Mr. Kocher, I think just looking at the cash flow, I think 2013 is going to be a critical year. We have many of our major projects are going to bid that year. So I anticipate fall of 13 we'll have a pretty good picture of what actually those projects are going to bid to be, where our cash flow is at that time. Right now it's a little hard to project because we're still in the development of these projects and not sure exactly what, you know, our costs are going to be. It's a fairly competitive environment out there from a bidding standpoint, so we might get better bids than we anticipate, even though our revenues are down. So there's a lot of variables in play. I think fall of 13 will be a good time to step back and say, you know, where are we now that we've let probably three-fourths of the money that are in the Section 64 of the JTA for us to kind of reassess where we're at. Right now it's not a good time. We're very early on in the process.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Weider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just looking at the track that we're kind of headed down here, and something I'm a supporter of is kind of paying for these as we go, because I believe the Jobs and Transportation Act was supposed to bring an additional $600 million per biennium, and you said we're about 7% off from that. So, and then how much of that was set aside for these projects?
I'm not sure the $600 million figure, I don't have it off the top of my head, but I know our overall state gas tax revenue is down about 7% than what we had projected it to be.
So from the overall value.
Yeah.
So it's actually going to be less than what we projected with the increase then. Mm-hmm. So, because a lot of those funds were off registration fees and stuff as well.
Yeah, so, and that, Kutcher Benson and I have talked about having some of our meeting time later this month be specifically focused on kind of working through and getting updates about where some of those more major projects are, as well as some of those dollars are going to O&M. But this may be a good sub-additional topic of looking at where we were talking about kind of the expenditure side, but also looking on the income side, seeing exactly where we are. And I assume it's maybe completely different trend lines between where the gas tax collections are versus the trucking tax revenues versus the vehicle registration fee revenues. But looking at all those trend lines and seeing how those line up or not.
Right.
One option would just be to prioritize the Newburgh-Dundee bypass last on the list, and then if we don't get to it, we'll make sure we fund all the other projects first.
Well, my point is kind of fund them all as they go, and it can be last on the list first. I don't care where it's on the list. It's,
we thought about gravel roads. Gravel's cheaper than
some people like horse and buggy.
Yeah, I think the corollary, the corollary argument, I think, though, is that if you're going to bond, I mean, in some ways, it's too bad that the projects aren't, there aren't a larger proportion of the projects ready to go. Because I would argue, in terms of a time to bond, when are we going to get cheaper money and cheaper construction prices and put people to work more that need it? So, in some ways, I would argue it's. And I understand because a lot of the land acquisition, environmental restrictions, that some of those projects are just not ready to go. Although,
but, yeah, Representative Ms. Co-Chair, actually, we're getting very close on many of the larger projects. A year from now, we will be in our bidding season for 2013, and many of those large projects I'm talking about will be on the street looking for
Representative bidding. Sheehan and I are very excited that the Sunrise Corridor project is one of those projects.
It is, yes.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you, Paul. Anyone else want to testify on this one? Close the public hearing on, well, so before I close that public hearing, because we have the Dash 1 amendments, we don't have the legislative and fiscal back yet. It does have a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means listed right now. My hope is that, actually, Paul, could you maybe just come up for one more second since we're in a public hearing? My sense would be that there's not going to end up being a fiscal impact statement on this. Maybe you said that and I just skipped right over it. What, can you give us your sense on that?
Mr. Co-Chair, that's correct. There will not be a fiscal on this on this bill.
Okay, great. Thanks for coming back. So hopefully when we get the fiscal, we'll then be able to ask to have the subsequent referral rescinded and be able to go straight to the floor. So that will be our plan maybe for, well, we'll see when we get the fiscal. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 4029. Any other business, Patrick or Co-Chair Bentz, that any other announcements we need to make today? So we're back here 8 a.m. tomorrow. If you haven't noticed, we're on a weird schedule. It's Monday, Wednesday, Thursday. Monday, Wednesday, Thursday at 8 a.m. We will see you tomorrow. We're adjourned.